everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to take on a topic that rarely is discussed in the mainstream or even alternative medias, and that is the controversies over Brexit, and not just the pros and cons of Brexit, but looking deeper at the whole history of it. And then we're going to also explore the Federal Reserve. This is very timely because the Federal Reserve just raised the interest rates again, and that caused $500 reduction in the equities market. Thus far, the equities market has lost approximately $3 to $5 trillion, depending upon whose figures you're accepting as legitimate. And James Corbett is my guest. He is in Japan. We are both on Skype. And James Corbett is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, a website he started in 2007 to provide critical analysis on politics, culture, economics, and history. He has written and recorded and hosted thousands of hours of audio and video, which has brought him to the attention of major independent media such as Russian TV. He is also the lead editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And James has directed several important documentaries, including How Big Oil Conquered the World, and his Century of Enslavement is perhaps the best film, in my opinion, exposing the dark history and corruption of the Federal Reserve System. His website, with his numerous podcasts, audio and video programs, and offerings, is Corbett Report, that's C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Nice to have you with us today, James.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
I'd like to begin with Brexit. Even though the Federal Reserve and Brexit are both important issues, the average American is simply unaware of what Brexit means. We have most of our mainstream media seems to oppose it in their editorializing, and they try to wrap it as something being done by a small group of people who are hyper-nationalist and from the right wing. And when I try to understand how the British intellectuals, how the different members of Parliament view Brexit and why it's important for them, or why not, and Ireland and Scotland barely stayed in the European Union as part of Great Britain. And I ask, who does it benefit? And I'll just give a brief history, and then I'll let you take it from there. In 1957, France, West Germany, Belgium, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands signed the Treaty of Paris, which established the European Economic Community. That's a predecessor to the European Union. And the European Economic Community was the last effort to foster economic cooperation between European countries after World War II. The UK first applied for membership in 1963, but France's President de Gaulle vetoed it. I'm imagining that he feared the English becoming a dominant language of the community. The European Union joined the United Kingdom joined the European Union in 1973, and under the Conservative government of Edward Heath. But in 2 years, already debate to leave, and a vote in 1975 ruled to stay. The Labour Party has advocated withdrawal from there being a single European market through the 1980s. And in the mid-1980s, Margaret Thatcher took a more oppositional stance towards the European Union, and opposition for full UK integration into Europe, starting with a conservative right government. And at the time, the players were jockeying for power and position, and they started looking at, what do we get? Well, 70% of farm subsidies made up of 70% of the total EU expenditures. In 1993, there was another treaty created by the Brussels-based European Union, and the EEC was renamed the European Community with the mission to integrate all members politically and economically, including the creation of a united foreign policy common citizenship and a single currency called the euro. And Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron, who is pro-European Union, but took a hard line against the European Union's abuse of the UK. He held his promise during the 2015 UK general elections for a referendum. And around 2013, a new party, the UK Independent Party, became the major advocate for a hardline stance to discontinue the EC membership. So the vote to leave the European Union won by 51.9%. That was 30 million people voting. And Cameron resigned and was succeeded by the former Home Secretary, Theresa May. A slim margin victory, yet most in Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to remain with the European Union. The UK is expected to formally be free on March 29th, but that actually didn't happen. Now, just a few pros and cons, and we're going to go over to you now. Take it from there, please, and James, give us what you consider the real reason. That's the official reason we were given for the European Union. Give us a real history of why they created the European Union, who was behind it, what are the pros for staying and the pros for leaving, and if you're an average British citizen or an Irish citizen or a Scottish citizen, why should this be of concern to you? The forum is yours.
All right. Well, thank you for setting the table that way, because it is very helpful to see the establishment narrative of the European Union and what Brexit means, so that we can contrast it with some of the real details that are always left out of that story. Because in our day and age, you're right, it is broadly associated with the right wing and hyper-nationalism, this Brexit movement and the idea of leaving the European Union. But that's actually an historical oddity, and of course also covers up the fact that there are people who are not necessarily right-wing or nationalist who are also in favor of Brexit. But I think the real history of this, we could go back as far as August of 1944. At nearing the end of the Second World War, the Nazis, obviously the top Nazi leadership, knew that the Nazi regime was destined to fail, that they were not going to win the war. And in August of 1944, they met at a hotel in Strasbourg called the Maison Rouge, aka the Red House, and they issued what is now called the Red House Report, in honor of the hotel's name. And basically, it detailed how those top Nazi officials meeting at that time, realizing that the Third Reich was destined to fail, were meeting with the top German industrialists at that time, including representatives of IG Farben, to begin preparations for the eventual rise of a Fourth Reich, which was to be a pan-European financial empire. And that was the crux of this. Now, the Red House Report, you can go and you can find information about it online. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is documented historical fact. And it's written about by very mainstream authors and historians like Adam Labore, who's written about the Bank for International Settlements and its part to play in this story. But essentially, their answer to how to maintain that quest for power that the Nazi regime embodied was to create a post-war Europe which would cede national sovereignty to a supranational body, and that would include eventually European unification monetarily and eventually ultimately politically. And so that really was the birth of the idea for what became the European Union project itself, which took more of a form in the 1950s under a Polish diplomat named Józef Rettinger, working in concert with people like Paul von Zeeland and some other highly influential people, including, of course, the Royal Dutch family at the time, to start what became known as the Bilderberg Group, which met for the first time in 1954 in Oosterbeek in Holland, at the Bilderberg Hotel. So they became known as the Bilderberg Group. And for many, many, many decades, it was derided as insane conspiracy theory to believe that the Bilderberg Group even existed. Well, they don't deny its existence anymore. They have their own website that you can go to. I believe it's bilderbergmeetings.org, where you can read about this group. But we now have some of the original minutes of some of the original Bilderberg meetings that have been posted online, including actually audio of part of the first Bilderberg meeting, where you hear at that time it was Prince Bernhard who introduced the first meeting, and you can actually go and listen to the audio of that. And from that very first meeting in 1954 and continuing on for a number of years, as we can now read in the minutes from those initial meetings, the Bilderberg Group was concerned, again, about the creation of a supranational European state. And they hit upon the idea in order to sell this to a public that was still, at the time, highly nationalistic. Europe, of course, for anyone who has spent any time there, countries that are next-door neighbors are not necessarily best of friends and often have long, very old historical rivalries. And in order to break down the walls of that, it was, of course, not presented to the public immediately as this is the European Union and we will cement all of these countries together in a supranational body that will overtake your national sovereignty or anything of that sort. It was presented to the public in 1957 as a trade agreement. It was about tariffs on steel, and it was just a step towards the creation of a greater European economic community. And that was the way they tried to frame it. But of course, that developed over time to more and more involve the creation of a European parliament and ultimately, of course, a European single currency. And how did we arrive at that point? It got to the point where in 2007, the European Union celebrated its 50th birthday, because it was 1957 when that first agreement was signed. But at the time, of course, no one thought of this as a European Union or some massive event. So to call it a 50th birthday celebration is somewhat disingenuous, and was notable for the fact that there were these various festivities and fireworks and things that that had been planned throughout Europe for the celebration of the 50th anniversary, which no one attended and no one showed up for, because there has never been a great mass popular movement for a European Union with a European supranational government. I don't think anyone is excited by that, or very few people have their hearts swell at that idea. It's just a bureaucracy that has evolved over time to encompass more and more of the lives of everyday Europeans. And I think people seeing this have always had their reticence about this agenda that is clearly being pushed and was there, as I say, from the very beginnings, with some of the very Bilderberg attendees actually being the signers of that first 1957 agreement. But that's reflected in the fact that back in the early part of last decade, the European Union was trying to push a constitution, a European constitution, that they were going to get all the European states on board with, so that they could have a European flag and a European parliament and European various institutions were going to be founded. The problem was that since it was actually a governmental body that they were talking about setting up that would supersede some of the powers of the national governments, there were a number of countries in the EU that necessitated a referendum. And it was not a popular proposition, and in fact, the Constitution came up for referenda in the Holland and in France, two of the key core European states, and both of them rejected the Constitution roundly, which really should have scuttled the entire idea. But the EU bureaucrats, not giving up, decided to merely rejigger and rename this European Constitution and turn it into the Lisbon Treaty, which, as a treaty, did not require ratification in referendum in most of the countries of the EU. The only country that required a referendum on the issue of signing the Lisbon Treaty was Ireland. So Ireland became the one place where the Lisbon Treaty, which was the EU constitution in all but name, it dropped some of the flag and the anthem and things like this, but it was essentially the EU constitution dressed up in different clothes. But the one country that got to vote on it was Ireland. So they did hold a vote on the Lisbon Treaty, and Ireland rejected the Lisbon Treaty, which again should have scuttled the Lisbon Treaty by the terms of the treaty itself. If it was rejected by any constituent state, it should have been scuttled altogether. But once again, the EU did not take no for an answer, and it came back a couple of years later to say, no, Ireland, you voted the wrong way. We're going to make you vote again. And there was another referendum, this time with a copious amount of highly dubious funds coming into on the pro-EU side of that vote. And this time, Ireland voted the right way, i.e. they voted for the adoption of the Lisbon Treaty, so it went ahead because that was apparently the right answer. And this is, I think, this is the context in which we can understand a movement that is arising and has been there, I think, has been there for decades against the EU and what it stands for, not only in Britain, in many countries, and we're starting to see that come to the surface now, but certainly in Britain, which has always considered itself somewhat apart from Europe, the continental Europe, from the time of the British Empire, obviously, and going on into the 20th century, there's always been the sense that Britain was apart from Europe, and it's set its own rules and its own laws and its own immigration policies and made its own trade deals. But all of that was subsumed in the EU and since the 1970s when Britain joined on with that. And so I think it's picking up on that historical thread, that resistance to it that has always existed, but has always been either ignored or swept to the side whenever it rises up. And that's where we find ourselves with this Brexit debate. It is an establishment idea for, as always, centralization of control in fewer and fewer and less accountable hands for the benefit of the very top of the power pyramid at the expense of the very many. And now that a populist movement is arising to reject that idea, it is going, of course, to be tarred with the brush, oh, these are just racists and neo-Nazis and everything, despite the fact that the historical thread actually links back literally to the Nazi Party in the Red House Report in 1944, which was really the birthplace of this idea of the supranational European financial empire.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. One other point, and then we'll wrap this segment up, and that is, from my reading of this, the members of the European Union, 17 hold their currency and 27 members, including countries like Italy and France and Greece, that there is no one in a country, like if you're a member from Great Britain or France or Italy, and you go to the European government that you're a part of, you really have no power. The people who are running the European Union and its actual governing structure are unaccountable. None of these other people have a chance to elect them, and now they want to have their own armed forces, their own defense group, and they want to have a lot more control over the individual industries in countries, and that can adversely affect them. And also, every one of these countries has to pay a fee to be a part of it, and they keep saying that the best thing about being a member of the European Union is you get to trade with all the other countries without any barriers, without any tariffs. You can travel from country to country without having a passport or visa, and that makes it unique. But then when you get into the details, you realize that these people, the countries who are part of the European Union, have abrogated their sovereignty in many respects to this larger dominant body that is unaccountable. Now, is that your understanding or not on this?
That very much is my understanding, because, and specifically because, what you're referring to is the fact that the European Union, the bureaucracy, the institutions of the European Union are so strange and complex and overlapping that probably not one person in 100 could really describe them to you, even the different branches of the European Union government proper. There's the European Parliament, which includes the MEPs, the members of European Parliament, that are elected, but there is also the European Council and the European Commission. And these are, the European Commission, for example, is responsible for proposing legislation, implementing decisions, upholding EU treaties, managing the day-to-day business of the EU, but the commissioners are not democratically elected. And it raises the interesting question you sometimes hear about the EU president, but there is a question as who exactly is the president? Because you have different people. You have the president of the council, but then you also have the commission president, and you have there's at least three different members within that EU bureaucracy that could be termed the EU president. So it's a strange bureaucratic jungle, and it gives the illusion, oh, well, there's MEPs, we elect something, so there's some sort of democratic component to this. But the real decisions are essentially bureaucratic in nature and technocratic in nature, i.e. there is a ruling governing class which is not beholden to the public in any form and is not accountable and is doing the day-to-day business of running the European Union itself. And that's the disconnect that most people feel, I think, in Europe in their day-to-day life when they look at this monstrosity that is this sprawling EU bureaucracy that there aren't very many inroads into for the average person. And I think that is experienced by the very real national politics that people are involved in, where at least you understand who's against who and what sides are here and what this vote means and what that vote means. And there's something that at least people can grasp onto, and there's some at least pretense of accountability and understanding of how that system works, versus the European Union, which for most people it might as well be on another planet. There's no way that they have any democratic or daily input into that they can touch or feel in their day-to-day lives. So it is, I think that's the disconnect, and that's why I think the anti-EU movement that is growing in sentiment throughout the European Union right now is essentially populist in nature, because people understand this is a technocratic institution that has been imposed on them from above and that they don't have any input into, and people are basically screaming out against that, which is, I think, a narrative that should resonate with people in the United States, and explaining something about the rise of populist movements in the U.S. in our era.
I also really challenge the European Union's legitimacy when they let Greece be manipulated, and Greece was buying submarines from Germany that it didn't need, couldn't afford, all forms of financial shenanigans occurring. And then when it finally was hit with massive austerity programs, the European Union did not come in, rescue it, forgive its debt, and allow it to get back up on its feet. And that was unfortunate, but it showed the people behind the scenes who were able to come in and privatize ports, roads, utilities, even museums, and the European Union did nothing about that. I'm not pro-European Union. I'm pro the sovereignty of individual countries, but for very practical reasons. Let us now go to what many consider one of the most important and pressing issues of our time. And I'll break it into three categories. The first is that we are bankrupt, literally bankrupt. I've reviewed the numbers. Richard Gill and I took months to get the government's own official numbers. For example, James, we found corporate debt and then state debt, city debt for all the cities in the United States, and personal debt in different divisions, for example, mortgages and car payments, student loans and credit cards. And once we put together all this debt, we found that it equaled over $200 trillion. That included entitlements and unfunded entitlements. Now, our gross domestic product is $20 trillion. So the United States was lambasting Greece that had a 300% debt to gross domestic product, and other countries that were between 100 to 250%, like Italy, France, and Ireland. And yet we had 1,200%. We have more money. We'll never be able to pay this money back. And that didn't even include the $6.5 trillion that had been given for our fiat currency, the treasury bills, like China and Saudi Arabia, et cetera. On the other hand, we say, and this is where it gets complicated, we say that we're thriving because we look at the gross domestic product. But then when we broke down the gross domestic product, we saw that a lot of that was people paying for bills with their credit cards because they had no cash, and then kiting it, paying one credit card with another one 30 days later, and they would juggle these credit cards. Well, if five $1 trillion of your so-called wealth is coming from people who are not using disposable income but are accumulating debt personally, then that's trying to make debt into an asset, and that's economic alchemy. It doesn't work in the long run. Also, many corporations are overvalued. For example, the utility companies like Chevron and Exxon, they're counting all the oil, gas, and coal they still have in the ground as a part of their total asset value. And then you have companies that are trading at dozens of times their earnings. I believe no company should be valued at more than three times their earnings. So if they're earning $1 million, it's $3 million. But if you're earning, you know, $100 million and you're valued at $2 billion, that's, again, that's mythical. And this is the game they play. Also, you have credit default swaps, derivatives. Five banks in the United States are now holding over $44 trillion in derivatives. And that's a small figure. I've heard higher figures of $66 trillion. So when you look at the total debt in the United States, and then you look at the total world debt, our debt exceeds our assets. So the world's bankrupt. And then at the heart of all this is we keep saying that the only way we can survive is to grow. That's depleting our assets. It is destroying the planet. It is the United States and India and China, China being the leading one, we're the second, India's third, contribute 53% of global warming. And control global warming by the most optimistic perspective of the nearly 2,000 scientists, you have to do something within 12 years. It would be like a worldwide Marshall Plan. Well, if the three leading polluters are increasing their consumption of beef and are growing their economies, and China now has what it's calling the world's largest city, it's three different provinces brought together in one industrial complex where people are living, all connected by high-speed trains. The first of those is now going online as we speak, and it has 140 million residents. Oh, and at the same time, when we looked at their carbon footprint for how are you going to have about 500 million people living in one city, the resources you need, the food, meat alone has gone up 300% in the average Chinese diet. How is that going to contribute to lessening global warming? It's going to increase global warming. So on the one hand, we have people saying we're going to do something, and I don't see any of that being done. I see euphemisms and platitudes, but no actual reduction. And then we're saying, but we're healthy, look at our economies. And I'm saying, no, some people are wealthy, but those are people making money off money. Look at everyone else. And the average American, over 100 million Americans, don't have $400 in their savings account. And they've got thousands of dollars in debt. So behind all this is one very, very unusual organization, the Federal Reserve. And that's where I want you to take it and show us a few things that nobody ever asks. If we owe approximately $1 trillion, it's approaching $1 trillion a year in debt, that's interest. All we're doing is paying the interest on the debt, which is $20 trillion. Who's that money go to? And the Federal Reserve claims they're not profitable. They make no profit, but they're made up of a series of regional banks. Do those banks make profit? And if so, who controls them and how much? And why isn't the Federal Reserve able to be audited, since it's controlling so much of our lives by controlling the interest rates? And when they bailed people out, they didn't bail any small business person out. 36 million small businesses in the United States employ the majority of people in the United States. They didn't help one. They didn't help a single person whose 7 million homes were foreclosed on. Even being conservative and saying there are three people per family, when many have four, it's 21 million people they put out on the street. Not a single person was protected or saved. Yet they put a total of $21 trillion over the period of 10 years through direct gifts to major corporations and took their bad assets and cleaned them. It's amazing that no one said, let's do an investigation. You have. You've done, in my opinion, the most important, critical, and scholarly work on the Federal Reserve. And I'm asking, why don't we abolish the Federal Reserve and let the Treasury print our money at zero interest and forgive all this interest debt and let us start over, as we forgave the debt of at least 500 major corporations, including Citibank at $2.3 trillion, and Wells Fargo and the Bank of America. And these were all over $1 trillion. We forgave their debt and gave them new money. Even Goldman Sachs, we gave $872 billion to. The forum is yours.
All right. Well, thank you for introducing it this way, because I think many people overlook what is the most important and fundamental part of this story. We can paint a very vivid picture of the economy and where it's at and what's happening and the overvaluation of various companies and things like this and the problem of personal debt and national debt. But if we examine that forest too precisely and just look at the individual trees, we will lose the bigger picture. And by that, I mean, what is really underlying the economic situation that we're in, this incredible situation of $21 trillion in national debt. I mean, an unimaginable, unfathomable number. And of course, that's only the conservative estimate. When you look at the long term in terms of commitments of the national government, it goes up from there. I will parenthetically note that $21 trillion is interestingly also echoed in another number that's being thrown around, which is $21 trillion of unaccounted for transactions that the DOD admits in its own Office of Inspector General reports over the past 20 years. There are $21 trillion in unaccounted for transactions that have gone through the DOD, which is an unfathomable number because that's many, many times larger than the entire budget of the Department of Defense over that time period. So how these transactions could possibly have been made or put on the books is, again, an incredible question, and one that I went into in great detail recently with Dr. Mark Skidmore of the Michigan State University, that in a conversation I hope your listeners will check out. But that's just one aspect of this phony baloney system that we're living in, where Dr. Skidmore points out that on October 4th of this year, a federal guideline was just passed, which absolutely, in black and white, allows every single department and every agency of the federal government to lie openly and legally on their books about where funds are going and what they are being used for, as long as what they are lying about is in the name of national security. That is now actually the law of the land. I know it sounds unfathomable, so please look into that story, but it's very true. So the entire economy is hocus-pocus and completely topsy-turvy and 100% smoke and mirrors. Having said that, how does this function? What is happening? What is going on behind the scenes? And to understand that, we have to look at the fundamental question, the monetary system itself. How does that function? How was it created? Where did it come from? Money does not grow on trees, as the old saying has it. So where does it really come from? And in the current system, by the logic of the system that exists today, yes, maybe we needed some sort of massive bank bailout because the entire engine of the economy would have seized and finance itself would have come to a grinding halt. But why? Why are we in that precarious position? It is because of the Federal Reserve System. And most people in the United States have probably heard of the Federal Reserve, but probably have no conception of a clue what it is or where it came from. The long story is contained in my Century of Enslavement documentary, so I hope people will check that out for free, 100% for free at corbettreport.com/Federal Reserve. But the summarization is that in 1907, there was a particularly bad bank panic that happened on Wall Street, which incidentally was facilitated and perhaps even started by J.P. Morgan, and there is ample evidence for that. But in that panic, one of the things that came out of it was a massive popular movement to establish a central bank, to oversee these banks that are playing with people's money and disturbing the whole economic and financial system. We need something more stable. We need a government central bank to come in and regulate that industry and to watch over the money supply. So, of course, as usual, the banksters got ahead of that curve, knowing that the panic was going to create this reaction. They got together, and in a meeting that was secret at the time but was revealed later by some of the people involved in it, including Frank Vanderlip, who was president of National City Bank of New York, in 1910, a bunch of bankers, mostly associated with J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller at that time, those powerful families who were very much central to the banking system at the time, they got together on an island, Jekyll Island, off the coast of Georgia, for a secret meeting with the assistant treasury secretary at the time, A. Piatt Andrew, and also the Senator Nelson Aldrich, who was a very powerful member of the Senate Finance Committee at the time, and also, by the way, the father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller Jr. And they, in that meeting, decided on how they would engineer a central bank system to basically help out Wall Street. And what emerged from that meeting was called the Aldrich Plan, and Senator Nelson Aldrich went back to Congress without having told anyone about this secret meeting that took place, and presented that plan. And everyone knew Senator Aldrich was part of the money trust, as it was called at the time, the money power. So they knew the Aldrich Plan is just what the bankers want. Let's vote, you know, let's not do that. So it didn't make it past the floor of Congress. No one wanted a part of that. So they just reframed it and called it by a different name, and suddenly it became the Federal Reserve Act. And this time it was being forwarded from the other side of the political aisles. There were Democrats behind it, and the new Democrat president, Woodrow Wilson, came into power saying he was going to contain the money trust, and he signed the Federal Reserve Act into power in 1913 to do just that, to chain the beast and to have some government oversight over this industry. Now, the thing that no one realized at the time, or very few realized at the time, was that the Federal Reserve gave lip service to the idea of being some sort of congressional-controlled government entity, but was in reality what they called a decentralized central bank that operated through these regional reserve banks, the most important, most influential, and the one that really dictated the system was the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which was Wall Street. Not only is its member banks comprised of the main Wall Street banks, but the actual ownership of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is a private entity as determined by law, and I put the attorney for the Federal Reserve regional banks arguing that in court in my documentary, so there's no argument there. The regional reserve banks are private banks, and they are owned by the constituent banks. So the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is owned by Wall Street, essentially, and it has been the driving force behind what happens in the monetary system itself in the United States for the past 100 years. Now, that's such a fundamental part of this story that always gets excluded from the narrative that you can't really understand anything that's happening in the story without that key fact. And without the fact that money in our current system is created as debt. It is created as debt. If you extinguished the national debt, you would essentially be extinguishing the monetary supply of the United States. The only thing that would remain would be the actual physical coins that were minted by the U.S. Mint, a fraction of a fraction of the overall monetary supply. So without understanding that, we can't understand anything. And where is this debt created? Well, of course, the Treasury issues its Treasury securities, which are then bought on the open market. And oh yeah, by the way, the Fed influences that. They have the Federal Open Market Committee, which decides how much of the Treasuries and bonds they should be buying and how much they should be selling into that market, which they can do by simply typing numbers on a computer screen and creating that new money that they can flood into the system, or taking that money out of the system by selling. And that's how they try to manage the economy. And so since that time of the formation of the Federal Reserve System, and there were some tweaks along the way, it really developed into what it is today in the 1930s. But now the idea is the Federal Reserve will manage the entire economy by, for example, its Federal Open Market Committee and its interventions into the market and setting interest rates. And now it is up to the Federal Reserve, which essentially is the private banks. That's who really controls the Federal Reserve System, who are now in control of the monetary supply itself. That's such a fundamental part of this story that how can we possibly discuss the rational way forward without discussing the very tenets of the system that we're living in? You can tinker at the edges and try to argue what the interest rate should be, or you could actually attack the problem itself, the central bank that is owned by the private banks that controls the monetary supply.
Let's take a look at how the Federal Reserve is able to give massive amounts of money with no sense of responsibility that they're giving it to private corporations, the AIG, the insurance company they give it to, but it's very select who they give money to. And how profitable is it for those private banks when a percentage goes to them and the Federal Reserve can then say, we don't make any profit? When indeed, if you read their history, they do. It's just not shown by them. Could you explain that, please?
Yes, I think people might have the wrong impression of this and what it means to have that power of the spigot, essentially, of monetary creation. And they might think that the Federal Reserve itself, as the Federal Reserve system, is somehow designed to make money that then the bankers get directly. It's not about that. It is about directing the economy itself, essentially, at the ground level, in this way or that way, for the interest of those who, A, are the first to receive that new money when it comes into the economy, and the first people to get that get the full spending power of that money. When it eventually trickles down, as they say, that's a diluted form. It's because of inflation. When the monetary supply greatly expands, well, the first people to get to use that money get to use it at its full power, but the people further down that economic ladder are ultimately spending inflated, deflated money. It's not worth as much as it would be at first. So that's one form in which the bankers directly profit from this. But to take it to even more literal level, there was $16 trillion of bailout facilities that were operated and extended by the Fed during the banking crisis, according to a 2011 Government Accountability Office report. And of that $16 trillion, which included emergency loans and other types of bailout funds, that was being directed by people like the board members of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So who sat on the Federal Reserve Bank of New York board? Well, that was people like J.P. Morgan Chase chief executive Jamie Dimon, who, oh, by the way, directed $391 billion of that Federal Reserve emergency lending to his own bank during that time of crisis. In fact, in all, the Federal Reserve board members of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York were tied to $4 trillion in loans that went back to their own banks. So again, that's another very direct way that the bankers profit from this. But I think the more fundamental part of this story is the money supply itself. The expansion and contraction of the money supply, it can have huge consequences for everyone in the economy, but people who know about that expansion and contraction and can work with it can make money either way, or can at least accrue more wealth either way, shall we say. During times of expansion, it's easy to invest and to reap profits. During times of contraction, if you're on the right side of that and are shorting the right things at the right time, you can make a lot of money as well. And it's impossible to overestimate how important this expansion and contraction of the monetary supply is. But because I have recently been talking about World War I on my podcast, and I've been looking at that era, it is important to note that the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913 was followed up just a few years later by the American involvement in World War I, which was largely financed by the Federal Reserve and its ability to create money to finance the treasuries that were being spent into the economy at that time. And the Liberty loans and all of that were just a tiny fraction. Really, it was underlaid by this new Federal Reserve system, which greatly expanded the money supply. And you can go and look at the M2 money supply chart for the early half of the 20th century, and you will see it was around the time of the creation of the Fed and the entry of the U.S. into World War I that suddenly the money supply starts to spike quite dramatically, continuing into 1919. By 1920, there's a slight contraction as obviously the economy comes off of its war footing. But throughout the 1920s, credit expanded greatly again, helmed by the Federal Reserve, which was brought into existence, let's not forget, on the Panic of 1907, specifically to control and to make sure that there was no great panics ever again. You see, throughout the 1920s, the money supply greatly expanding, even beyond, almost doubling the heights that it reached in World War I. And of course, then you have Black Tuesday, and you have a dramatic contraction of the money supply between 1929 and 1933. And that is the Great Depression. That really was what was going on there. It was dramatic and sudden tightening of capital that was overseen by the very entity that was brought into existence to try to make sure this never happened again. And that's exactly what happens every single time we look at these panics that are brought about by the actions of the Federal Reserve and its members. Like in 2008, again, we saw the popping of the dot-com bubble was quickly plugged by Greenspan, who was at that time the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, by the creation of a housing bubble, which eventually he admitted, yeah, was a bubble, but not too late for it to have any effect. Of course, we saw the popping of that bubble in 2008, and we've seen the inflation of another bubble since that time. which was the dramatic infusion of trillions of dollars, ultimately, on the books of the various banks. This hasn't, of course, filtered down to the average person. It's the banks that have profited from this, but that has created this economic unreality bubble of the equities markets that we are starting to see, specifically in the past month or two, we're starting to see the beginnings of the pricking of that bubble and what it could result in. And this isn't some academic enterprise that we're engaging in here. This is truly the basis of the economy that governs the lives of hundreds of millions, ultimately billions of people around the world, because what's happening in the United States obviously affects the rest of the world. And I think, again, most people don't understand this or understand that the bankers can directly profit from times of great contraction and crisis, and they do so.
James, could you explain for the listeners what it means when a person goes to buy a house and where that money comes from? Because some people are under the impression that it's our savings that are in banks that provide that bank with the fractional reserve money to loan it out to someone. And that's not the actual picture. So explain to our audience how transactions occur today versus historically when we didn't have the Federal Reserve, and the difference in our total debt and the debt we have today about who can create money and when they want it and how they do it and how risky is this? Have we learned any lessons from the crash?
Unfortunately not, and that's again because very few people understand anything about the banking system as it exists. People think that they are basically taking their money and putting it in the bank for safekeeping, and that they will come and get that money back out of the bank's vaults. I mean, I don't think many people think it's literally the same dollar bills that you give to the bank are the ones you're getting back, but that's the image we have. Well, they've got it, you know, stored in there somehow, and we'll get it back. But that's not really what happens when you go to the bank and you're putting money in the bank. You are actually lending money to the bank, and it's called demand deposits. But essentially, you are lending money to the bank, and they will give that money back when you ask for it, assuming they have it. But interestingly enough, yes, again, because of that image we have that we're giving money to the bank and they're using it for safekeeping, and then when we get a loan, well, there's some money they have in their vault somewhere that they're giving back to us. And again, of course, it's all electronic these days, but that's the sort of analogy that we use. But that is not true. When you go to the bank for a loan, when you take out a mortgage, when you have a car loan, this money is not money that is actually stored somewhere. It is literally created into the economy. It's created by the bank at the time that they issue that mortgage, on the basis of the fact that that's part of their bank charter. They are participants in this Federal Reserve System, so they have the ability to literally create money out of nothing based on nothing other than your promise to pay it back eventually, which again is the underlying linchpin of the economy. Money is created through debt, which is why we are in a system where we are told we have to constantly grow and expand the economy, because there is no easy way to contract the economy. There's no nice and soft way for an economy to contract, because it is based on this debt cycle where people have to go out and spend more and get more and buy more and spend more again in this never-ending cycle to keep up that debt bubble. That's really what is driving it, and it's based on this fact that that banks create this money out of nothing, which you then owe back to the bank, obviously, when you take out a loan, with interest. So you were required to pay back more than was actually created at that moment, which means that at some point, someone is going to have to create more so that you can get that extra bit that you're going to have to pay back to the bank, and then they'll have to get out more, et cetera. It's the never-ending debt treadmill, and that is engineered, that is baked into the cake of the system. And it works to an extent as long as everything is growing. But as I say, there's no easy contraction. There's no way for that to ever stop. It will collapse if it actually stops.
When you look at the banks today, where would you put your money, and what do you see the future of our current economy being, including the banks, since they have so much power politically and economically? Would they be hurt as they were in 2008, or would they survive, and the average person, small businesses, once again would take the shellacking?
Well, I think that the answer is not going to come in any one form or any one place. I think part of the problem is that we have been socially engineered and mentally put into this construct where we believe that everything has to come down to one system. There is one dollar bill. We use the dollar, and it has to be controlled and issued by the federal government and by way of this Federal Reserve System. I think that's part of the problem here, is that everyone thinks that this has to be a monopolistic system. I think there should be many decentralized alternatives, and that can take many different forms. I mean, one of the simplest, and I think one that would have an effect, maybe not solve all problems, but would have an effect, was the Move Your Money campaign that we saw about a decade ago in the wake of that financial crisis, where people were being encouraged to take their money out of the big banks and put them in local savings and loans, local credit institutions, so that, at the very least, you can get it more local than in these national mega banks that are part of this Federal Reserve System. But secondarily, you can also start to form something of an alternative economy through those types of networks. And also, invest in your own local area. It's a win-win sort of situation. And that can be extended even further. As I've talked about on my program, there are lots of ideas for local currencies that have been not only tried, but actually successful in various places. I've talked, for example, about Ithaca Hours. There's various LETS systems, local exchange trading systems, and other types of ideas for community currencies, which keep the spending power and the wealth that generates in a community, so to actually help the real local businesses, rather than in some sort of monolithic Federal Reserve System, which ultimately only ends up helping the banksters. So there's those types of ideas. There's also things like cryptocurrency, which I think is disruptive and decentralized for transacting outside of one's local community. How do you do that without, well, I mean, in this day and age, without using PayPal and Patreon and all of these major financial payment systems, which themselves are controlled and in bed with the banks and governments that are part of this international central banking system? Well, cryptocurrency is one example of how that can be done. But I always say I don't think any one of these is the silver bullet that will be the be-all and end-all solution to all of this. I think we have to get out of that mindset that there is a single silver bullet and look in the various ways that we can disintermediate the banks, which essentially are this big entity sitting in the middle of all of our transactions that we do with everyone in the world, when they don't really have to be. We are getting to the point technologically where we are capable of getting around or getting directly interacting with people rather than going through banking middlemen and the banking middlemen's currency, which itself is dictated and controlled by the banksters. I think there has to be an awareness that we can get around that, and an awareness of the need to get around that, which I think is starting to dawn on the public, especially in the wake of the last decade of financial fiasco.
I appreciate that. My final question is, it's a guess, and it's subjective, and that's fine. But since you're so in tune with economies and the market, what do you see is the likely outcome in the equities market and what we're doing with all this speculative investments, and where up right now, many very wealthy people are putting almost all of their money into equities at 100% margin. So they're not investing their money, they're getting credit and hope that their investments make them money before what they have invested is due. And that's, a lot of people would think if you're that wealthy and you have $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, you know, don't put it at risk. And these people know that they're putting it at risk because they want these higher returns. Whatever they had doesn't seem to be enough to satisfy their standard of living. So at some point, there has to be a reckoning. This is a massive bubble. There's a commercial real estate bubble, a credit card bubble, a student loan bubble, and there's a debt bubble. We have at least six major bubbles that we're involved in, and no one's talking about it. So give us your foresight, what you believe is going to happen.
Yes, well, there's no way out of a bubble pop other than there are two alternatives. One is the actual expansion and creation of an authentic economy to basically fill up that bubble. But I think given the fact that we're dealing with unimaginable amounts of potential bubble debt in the form of derivatives, as you talked about earlier, which some estimates put that in the hundreds of trillions, some go up to a quadrillion dollars of derivative debt, which isn't even imaginable because it's many times over what the entire world economy produces in a year. So it can't even be fathomed, that those types of sums. So if that were to pop, the only way out would be to expand the economy to that size to basically accommodate that, which would involve the, I don't know, free energy technology or something so unimaginable and so completely fundamentally revolutionary to everything that we think about the world that it would ultimately transform what our understanding of economy is. So that doesn't seem quite so likely in the near future. Or the other possibility is to try to inflate the bubble again through another method. And we saw that, of course, the popping of the dot-com bubble led to the growth of the housing bubble. The popping of the housing bubble led to the quantitative easing bubble, which essentially is the everything bubble, the bond bubble, the stock bubble. Everything is in a bubble phase. Now that that is starting to pop and we see the signs of stress coming in that, is there another bubble to inflate? It's a very real question because 10 years ago, people would have thought things like negative interest rates were literally impossible, unimaginable. That doesn't make any economic sense whatsoever. Well, we've seen them happen now. So we've bent the rules of economics and what people thought was even possible in order to accommodate this current bubble. If this pops, what else is there to do? It's certainly not something that I can envision a way out of. But if I know anything, it's that the bankers are incredibly creative in the ways that they use to maintain their system. But then again, as I say, in times of contraction, there are people who can be poised to make money, and there are people who actually want a contraction so that they can accrue more wealth. That is what happened in the Great Depression. It wasn't necessarily that all this money went out and no one had any. It was that certain people in certain positions were well positioned to take over the real economy at pennies on the dollar when the crash happened. And that's what we have to worry about, I think, ultimately, is the fact that some people are motivated to let a crash happen. Again, what is the easy way out? I don't think there is one. I think we have to start constructing the alternatives to this entire system. And that's the things that I was talking about with community currencies and cryptocurrencies and other ways to get around the banking system as it exists. Because this system, as it exists, the logic of the system is collapse and crisis.
I appreciate your insights very much. James, thank you very much for taking this hour with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
From Japan, via Skype, James Corbett. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer. For all in love.